Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here with co-host Jeff Pitino.
How are you?
And we are the guys that work at the Binary Research Institute, where we explore ancient cultures and civilization during different periods of time. And today we have a very interesting guest that has written a best-selling book on a part of time that we normally don't look at, and that is time on Earth without us. And our special guest today is Alan Weisman. He's an award-winning journalist. He's written a book which has been just getting rave reviews across the country, and it's called The World Without Us. And Jeff, can you give us a little bit more on his background?
Sure. Alan, like you said, Walter, is an award-winning journalist, and he's written articles that have appeared in Harper's, New York Times Magazine, Atlantic Monthly, Discover, and he's also been on NPR and other shows. He's a former contributing editor to the Los Angeles Times Magazine, and he's a senior radio producer for Homelands Productions, and he teaches international journalism at the University of Arizona. And his essay, Earth Without People, is what his book, The World Without Us, expands on. And Alan, welcome to the program. I have to tell you, your book is one of my all-time favorites. I was just fascinated by it when I read it a couple months ago.
Well, thanks so much. I'm grateful.
Yeah, it's not only fascinated you, but these reviews I'm reading are just spectacular, too. So you've been getting around. When did it come out, Alan?
The book came out in the United States in July. Actually, through a publishing quirk, the French edition came out first, even though my initial publisher who contracted me to do this is an American publisher. And now the book is either out or will be out in about 30 different languages. So it continues to appear in various countries.
That's fantastic. What originally prompted you to start researching the topic and write the book?
Well, I have been a journalist for more than 20 years, and much of that time I have been covering environmental issues simply because every story is an environmental story. I don't necessarily consider myself or pigeonhole myself as an environmental reporter, but early on in my career, I learned from environmental scientists and ecologists that, you know, literally everything is connected. So whether I'm writing about religion or culture or economics or international relationships, it all comes down to the ground underneath us. Either without it, you know, we don't have a place to stand, literally, or it has formed so much of our societies, our cultures, our belief systems. We're all connected to the land. Well, I have gone from the Arctic to the Antarctic to lots of places in between. I've seen just magnificent things, and I've also seen a lot of terrifying things. I've covered a lot of environmental disasters all over the world, and I began looking for a way to bring all these things together, because they do connect to one another, and I think that it's very important that readers, that the public in general, understand that the death of a polar bear in the Arctic, or an ozone hole hanging over the Antarctic, or a burning rainforest, or an ecosystem that's being mowed down somewhere in the tropics, all are connected to one another, and particularly through their repercussions on us. But the problem, when you bring together all these different events into one global problem, is that it just feels so overwhelming that a lot of people just aren't going to pick up a book to read it. And you need a book to explain all of this in detail. But, you know, a book is really a serious commitment of anybody's time. And who wants to pick up something that is bound to be so depressing or downright frightening?
Well, hold that thought on downright frightening, because I think you set the stage so well. We're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. We were just talking about what a big idea this is. And why do you think it's touched such a chord? Is it because of this innate connection we all feel to the earth?
Well, I think that we all are connected to the earth, whether we consciously or subconsciously understand that. You know, unquestionably, we are born of the earth, you know. We're all made out of stardust, as an astronomer mentioned to me last night. The concern, you know, that I had been dealing with was, how do you talk about this connection in the crisis, the global environmental crisis, without scaring readers off? Because it's just frightening to consider all of this stuff in mass. So I've been looking for a way to tell the story so readers would keep turning the pages. And it occurred to me, if the bottom line is that we, just like any other species, feel so protective that, you know, we're worried, are we all going to die? Is something going to, you know, come in and kill us? That maybe the best way to tell this story would be to pose a situation in which we're already gone. And yet, through the magic of literature, readers get to hang around to see what happens next. And, you know, we're all sort of fascinated by the concept of the future. We'd love to know what will go on after we're gone. And so in the beginning of this book, I pose some scenarios that are both remote enough that that's not going to frighten readers. For example, you know, some scenarios in which we could possibly disappear very, very quickly. You know, say a Homo sapiens-specific virus picks us all off. Maybe AIDS is airborne or something like that, and instead of just passed by fluids. Or some evil genius comes up with some nanomechanism that infects us all or sterilizes us all.
Comet, meteor, you bet.
No, nothing like that, actually, at all.
Oh.
I didn't want anything apocalyptic.
Because of the destruction involved.
Exactly. You know, another scenario that a lot of people believe in is a rapture, whether it be by Jesus or by space aliens who take us to some zoo across the galaxy. But, you know, just something that is remote enough that no one's going to, you know, really believes the chances are very high that it's going to happen next week. On the other hand, it's plausible enough that we're not talking fantasy or science fiction, because a lot of readers won't pick up those kinds of books. But from that moment on, supposing we were gone, how would the rest of nature proceed without us? To what extent could it recover the land, restore itself, heal itself, cover up all our traces? What would it do with all the stuff we left behind? Have we done anything that's really indelible? Have we created materials that are indestructible? What about our huge infrastructure? What about all the carbon that we've pumped up our chimneys? How long would it take for nature to reabsorb all that and restore some equilibrium? And ultimately, the reason that I pose all this stuff is that by wiping human beings away and getting rid of these human distractions, we can see how nature would perform, and it turns out it would perform rather beautifully. And then ask ourselves, wow, if nature could come back that quickly, if we only eased up on our pressures, isn't there any way that we could have that and still be a part of it ourselves? In other words, still be, you know, retain a world with us rather than have to, you know, think about a world without us that would, you know, depend on our demise in order to heal.
True. Let me just quickly quote the California Literary Review here. They said, World Without Us is a rare book indeed that reawakens the reader to the gorgeous wonders of the natural world while simultaneously evoking the creepy shivers of a stroll through a haunted house. But that's the best way I can think of to characterize my reaction to The World Without Us. And it also gives me great hope when I read this, because we hear so much that our, you know, environment is just being irrevocably wrecked. And yet when the pictures you have painted of how quickly things come back is a very positive one in many respects.
Well, to be specific, it's how quickly life comes back. It's how quickly nature comes back. It's not necessarily specific things that we have smashed so hard that they've actually been destroyed. I mean, we right now are causing a lot of other species to go extinct, and they're not going to come back, but other things will take their place. This has happened often in the history of the Earth. In fact, long before we came here, you know, we appeared at five different times in geologic or history. The Earth has gone through massive extinctions. I mean, you mentioned before comets or asteroids. There have been a couple of those that have really done away with an awful lot of living systems on the Earth. I mean, the biggest one of all was the Permian extinction, which happened 250 million years ago. And that was a combination probably of two events. One was a huge volcanic eruption in what today is Siberia that not only lasted for a million years and threw a lot of sulfur into the atmosphere, but it came up right through the Carboniferous layer. So talk about global warming. This was burning an awful lot of coal. Mm-hmm. And sometime in those million years, it appears that an asteroid struck what is today Antarctica. When the dust settled from all of this stuff, 95% of all life forms on Earth were gone. And the land was pretty devastated. There was only one big continent at the time. But eventually life crawled out of the oceans and started all over again. And eventually that gave us this pretty fabulous age of dinosaurs. It took millions of years. But the Earth was a very, very lush and fertile place, populated by immense creatures. And they lasted for millions of years. And then another asteroid hit about 65 million years ago around the area of the Yucatan, and that kicked up a mess that the dinosaurs couldn't adapt to, and so there was another big dieback. But then we get this age of mammals, of which we are part of. And, you know, nature, I mean, one of the things that I found in researching this book, and I went all over the world, and I went to some incredibly contaminated places, such as Chernobyl, or such as places where we used to make nerve gas, or I went to agricultural fields that have been hammered for over 100 years with fertilizers and then later on pesticides and herbicides when they were invented. And you find that even in the most sterile environments, life always finds a way to come back. It's really awe-inspiring. And it's awe-inspiring to anybody, whether they think that this is a spiritual force or whether they're a secular humanist or a scientist and just believe that this is nature and biology and physics at work. But it always finds something that will grow. And that something that grows will then decay, you know, die, lay down biological matter that will gradually create more topsoil that will bury whatever has devastated things before that, and eventually more organisms, plants, and then animals will seize the opportunity to come into this new ecosystem, and life will renew itself. It'll be a little different than the way life was before, or sometimes a lot different than the way life was before, but it's always life, and frankly, it's just magnificent to be a part of it.
It certainly is, and it's magnificent the way you opened the book and depicted the stages that a major city would go through, New York City, if we weren't there to maintain it. Can you recap that just briefly for a reading?
Let me start just a little further back, because I begin the book really, in a sense, the way that the authors of Genesis began in the Old Testament. I begin in paradise. I show this fragment of remaining primeval forest in Europe,
right,
which was preserved as a royal hunting preserve by a Polish king back in the 14th century, and then was handed down to a series of more kings and then Russian czars, and then eventually became a national park in the 20th century. And it's on the Polish-Belarusian border. And the reason why I begin there is that it's a place that it's a temperate forest, so it looks like a lot of what most of us who grew up in the Northern Hemisphere would commonly recognize. I mean, there's oaks and there's pines and there's ash trees and a lot of the species that we're familiar with. But they are gigantic. And, there's this just sense that you've walked into this forest that you've imagined in your mind's eye when you've read Grimm's fairy tales. Only the odd thing about it is that it doesn't seem strange and exotic. It seems like familiar on some cellular or some primal level. Your body or your genetic memory, recognizes this thing. And then from there, once I establish the fact that there's something that we all do miss subconsciously and we do all long for, this feeling of paradise that feels even more complete than the world as we know it, these comparatively puny second growth forests that we have, then I've got to look at what, has separated us from nature. And I literally have to tear down the walls. I have a chapter that shows how your house would fall apart if you weren't maintaining it. But the one that really gets to people is the one that you just talked about. A gigantic city. I mean, how could these things possibly fall apart? Well, I show in New York, that it would happen rather quickly. There, places are vulnerable. And subway engineers took me underneath the city, and they showed me how, this Manhattan, the word refers to hills. It's an old Algonquin term. Used to have all these hills and with streams in between them that drained them to the ocean. And when those hills were mashed down to superimpose a grid of streets, then those streams were pushed underground. Of course, there's already groundwater, and they've got to keep 800 pumps going all the time to wick away 13 million gallons of water that to the sea. Otherwise, the subways would flood because they're pumping uphill.
That's just mind-blowing.
Yeah, and if they weren't there, or if nobody, there were no humans and no one were manning the power plants, within 2 or 3 days, the subways would flood. And then those columns that hold up the streets, which are made out of steel, would start to rust and corrode, and civil engineers and structural engineers I talked to estimated that within a couple of decades, a lot of them would start to collapse and buckle, and then the streets would cave in, and suddenly there would be rivers on the surface of Manhattan again. And birds would be dropping herring or mollusks or other things. And within a surprisingly short period of time, life will invade anything that we abandon. Structural engineers who maintain bridges in Manhattan told me how it's amazing. You get these what could be more sterile than two big pieces of plate steel coming together? And yet constantly a bird will fly over and it will defecate out a seed, and the seed will have enough bird poop that it will lodge into a crack between these two steel plates, and the thing will start
much.
To sprout, and it's going to start to push them apart.
Yeah. And you multiply that thousands, tens of thousands, millions of times, you can see how that happens very quickly.
Yeah, it's, any building superintendent in Manhattan will tell you that they're constantly monitoring the roof for leaks, because if you get a leak coming down the walls, and if the concrete gets wet, and if the reinforcing bar inside of it gets wet, it will start to rust. Rust takes up much more space than steel. And it will just start to expand and crumble the concrete.
Well, we'll get back to the crumbling city right after we return from this break. You're listening to Cosmic Influence.
And welcome back to Cosmic Influence. I'm Jeff Bettino with our host, Walter Cruttenden. And today our guest is Alan Weissman, the author of a fantastic book, The World Without Us. Right before we went to break, Alan, we were talking about New York City and how quickly things tend to crumble, and all the details that people don't think about every day that really go into maintaining a city and keeping it from falling apart.
It was very interesting to me talking to a whole variety of people who help hold a city together to understand how things would begin to dissolve without the presence of humans. In fact, though, it wasn't my intention or my theme for this book. This book really becomes a celebration of all these maintenance personnel who hold civilization together. I mean, you know, frankly, we think about our political leaders as being the heads of civilization. You can get rid of all those politicians, and life would continue on just fine. I mean, you know, even before we had them, we participated in trade, in commerce, we created art, we did all the things that human beings do. But if we got rid of the maintenance people, the people who pump our subways, the people who show up in our power plants to man them every day, the people who patch our sidewalks, etc., things would fall apart fast. And in the case of New York, I show how, well, just think of it. Suddenly, everybody's gone. An uncountable number of plastic bags that blow around cities would clog all the sewers. And then all the leaf litter that would come out of the parks, like Central Park or Gramercy Park, all these things would start to fill the gutters. Seeds are constantly blowing around on the wind. And, in fact, I have an episode in the book where I show the High Line, which is this abandoned railroad trestle, which is the end of the street because it used to go right into the second story of warehouses on the west side in Chelsea. And that was abandoned in 1980, and now there's a beautiful ecosystem that's growing up there. There's wildflowers, there's even trees, all sorts of things, and they rooted just in airborne soot. So imagine all the plants that would be rooting and all the leaf litter that would be gathering in the gutters and in the streets, and every single crack would get colonized. They do every spring anyhow. Sidewalk maintenance people have to get rid of them, otherwise they will start breaking up the pavement rather quickly. Fire would then blow through. There'd be no firemen, and eventually some dead branches would get hit by lightning. And this would ignite eventually a building, and the insulation and the paper inside the building would add carbon to this new growing soil cap, of mulch in the streets. And within 500 years, you'd have a pretty mature forest in the streets. In the meantime, concrete would have crumbled. The oldest buildings in New York would be the ones left standing, the ones that are made out of rock, you know, that's the stuff of the earth itself, like St. Paul's Chapel. The oldest building in the city is made out of Manhattan schist, which is the stuff of the island itself. It's right across the street from the World Trade Center, and that thing didn't budge when the planes hit. It would probably be the last to go.
So you might not see it in the forest, but it would still last. Yeah,
it would probably be shaded by a lot of big trees by then, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, another point you made in there was this one part near the train tracks you were talking about where this ecosystem developed so quickly, this little patch of nature. And I believe you'd mentioned that neighbors could look down on this and really took delight in it.
And yeah, it's wonderful that they have a civic movement came up. I mean, we can literally call this one grassroots because there's a lot of grass growing up there, and they convinced the city of New York to make it a park. It is now the newest park in New York City. It's called the High Line. And
it just shows you, too, how much man's soul wants to be around nature, you know, that when it comes, you can't take it away or people are going to get in an uproar. I don't think it was that way 30, 40, 50 years ago. I don't know.
Well, I think 30, 40, 50 years ago, we still were all believing, you know, just as we had grown as a species to believe that there were no limits to nature. We could constantly keep expanding. There would always be more stuff out there. The thought of losing things had barely occurred to us. I mean, you know, and I'm not saying that no one had noticed it. I mean, obviously, people like John Jay Audubon and John Muir and Aldo Leopold, you know, our great nature writers of the 19th and early 20th century, had warned us that we could lose things. I mean, at one point in the book, I bring up the famous example of the passenger pigeon, which went extinct in 1914. I mean, you have to remember, and we don't generally remember, because there's no way that we can conceive of how many passenger pigeons were. This was the most abundant bird species on Earth.
They used to blot
their
out
flocks
the sky.
Were 300 miles long. They would darken the skies. There were so many of them, and they were right here in America. Nobody ever thought we would, you know, there were limits to the number that we could lose by hunting them down. But it happens that as we cleared away so many of the forests to plant crops that we human beings eat, we were clearing away their habitats. And they had less and less to eat, and also they were funneled into just, you know, thousands of them would be in a single tree roosting, you know, fighting for space, and then they were easy pickings for hunters. And boxcars of these things used to be shipped to New York and Boston every day because they were considered delicacies, this big fat pigeon, and then they were gone. Well, now, you know, 30, 40 years ago, we started to notice that as human population doubled and then doubled again in the 20th century, we were eating everything up a lot faster, including, you know, sheer space, not just other species.
Yeah. You'd also mentioned that the population has grown just tremendously. I think in the year 1900, it was about 1.5 billion, and we were crossing 6 billion just 100 years later. I'd like you to comment on that, but we're going to need to take a break here very shortly. Is there a website where people can get a hold of you later?
Yeah, there's a website for the book, worldwithoutus.com, and it explains everything, and there's ways to contact me. Yes.
Terrific. Okay, we're talking today with Alan Weissman, the author of The World Without Us. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. Alan, as mentioned, as you had mentioned, the populations of humans has increased dramatically over the last 100 years, from 1.5 billion to 6 billion. And I believe in your book you had commented on other species where the population has increased dramatically, and they all seem to correct at some point.
Well, when I wrote this book, I mean, my original impetus was because I was concerned about what we were doing to the Earth. And I did not want to scare readers away, either by frightening them that we were in impending, peril, or I also didn't want to scare off readers who have either emotional or cultural or political reasons for avoiding environmental books. Fortunately, because I'm trained as a journalist, I'm not really an environmentalist. I just simply report facts. I mean, throughout the book, I was able to just take people to interesting places and show them interesting things, like we've discussed about New York City. And I went to places like the Korean Demilitarized Zone and show them how this, you know, abandoned strip between these two warring armies inadvertently has become this precious nature preserve in Asia. Go to all these different places and just let the facts speak for themselves. Now, toward the end of the book, I drop in another fact that a lot of readers told me that, you know, if I had started out the book with this, they would not have read the book because they just would have been turned off immediately. But by waiting till the end, it became so obviously clear to them that this was something that we have to confront that they just kept reading on. And that fact is that every 4 days there's a million more of us on the planet. And this is just simply not sustainable. I mean, you know, any four-year-old kid who's learning how to do story problems in first grade knows that at a certain point, too many is going to run out of, you know, the stuff that it takes to maintain itself. And throughout biological history, every species that has reached the end of its resource base suffers a population crash. And sometimes that population crash is fatal. The whole species goes extinct because they've run out of things to eat. You know, it happened to saber-toothed tigers, for example. it happens, you know, a swarm of locusts, after they've eaten up all the stuff in the fields, they have a big dieback. Well, humans in the 20th century began to really expand the population for two reasons. One of them is a very nice reason. We developed some medical technologies that lowered infant mortality and helped expand our lifespans. The other one, agricultural technology, has in many cases tripled the yields through genetic selection. But we've paid a price for that one. You know, the idea was the Green Revolution was going to solve hunger on the planet. That's what we were told. But in fact, the Green Revolution has created so much more food that the population just expanded to meet it, as always happens in biology. And now we've got three times as many hungry people. Plus, because these are laboratory-produced plants, they needed to be protected when they're planted outside, which meant, you know, force-feeding, protecting them with herbicides and pesticides, and also these plants are force-fed with chemicals. And now the soils are poisoned, and, you know, the obvious proof of that is that you look to see where the soils wash into the estuaries of rivers, and, you know, there are big dead zones on the ocean. There's one in the Gulf of Mexico that's said to be the size of New Jersey as a result of all the chemical agricultural waste. Plus, we've been scraping away forests and ecosystems in the tropics to plant yet more food that gets exported to us in the Northern Hemisphere. And that means that we are both losing important ecosystems where, for example, migrating birds pass through, and they need these things on their migratory routes, and that's why suddenly we've our populations of birds are declining severely. And also, you know, you're scraping away the food-growing livelihood of people who live in the tropics, so small wonder that we have huge immigration issues along our southern border in the United States or in Europe. You know, so many people from Africa and Indonesia are showing up because they no longer have a way of sustaining themselves. So all this stuff catches up with us, and this is sort of nature's way of balancing things out. And I'd say that we are headed for a population crash, and it may be one that nature imposes on us, which is not going to be very pretty, unless we, of course, choose to manage it ourselves.
Well, that's the message, really, of eco-psychology. I guess it works both ways. We're part of nature. We can't just separate ourselves and expect there not to be any consequences.
Well, we have believed that we could. I mean, at a certain point, we diverged from, you know, it started back in pre-industrial times when we convinced ourselves through various religious beliefs that we were a very special creature that was really above the animals, somewhere hanging between the angels and the animals, I guess, and that the laws of nature did not necessarily apply to us. Now, you know, that's besides...
Well, it's Ash Wednesday.
That we tend to die like any other species does, but, we convinced ourselves there was an afterlife waiting for us. So we were rather special. And then industrialization gave us some technologies that made us believe that we really could dominate nature, but the fact is we never have dominated nature. Nature always wins.
Yeah. Well, we might be special, but we need to be smart about it.
We need to be wise about it. I think we are smart. It takes smart people to create these technologies, but it takes wise people to understand what the limitations are and to make them work in harmony rather than in combat with the rest of the planet.
Beautifully stated, yeah.
The question's not should we do it or not could we do it, it's should we do it.
Well,
sometimes.
I think that there's lots of things that it's worth finding out if we can do it and experimenting, but at a certain point, we tend to overdo things or we tend to forget that our power, we all know that power corrupts, and, you know, the power to go so far and to dig so deep and to harvest so much, brings us wonderful riches, but at a certain point, it starts, literally tearing apart systems well, that we depend on biologically.
Yeah. Well, hold that thought. We'll be right back with Cosmic Influence.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. Alan, this show's just flown by. We've got one segment left for you, left with you, and one of the things I'd like to talk about that you speak a lot of in the book is what things will last, what our legacy as a culture might be, both the bad things and the good things, thousands or millions of years from now.
Well, a whole variety of things that humans have done will last. In fact, as a biologist showed me, we see stuff now that, for example, you go into the Amazon and you see these pockets of Brazil nut trees or durian fruit trees in Indonesia or tea trees in Burma, and they're part of the wilderness, but really those are faint echoes of societies that were once there, and they're gone now, but their cultivations got absorbed into the ecosystem, and a lot of what we are doing right now, a lot of the plants that we have transplanted, from one continent to another, long after we're gone, it'll be a new ecosystem that will bear this echo of the fact that we were here. But then there's materials that we've created. I have a whole chapter about plastics, and this is the newest substance on Earth in many ways. It's a hydrocarbon that enzymes or microbes have not created the enzymes to digest yet. So except for a little bit that's been incinerated, virtually all the plastic ever been created is still around. And microbes eventually will learn how to eat it. I mean, it took them hundreds of thousands of years to figure out how to digest lignin, which is why a lot of the original trees never decayed. You know, when they died, they lay there, and then they got buried, and eventually they got compressed into coal. So plastic will enter the geologic record, and there'll be Barbie dolls and computers, or at least their imprints, left for future geologists to find. Radioactive materials, a lot of our radioactive waste, it's U-238 and that stuff occurs in nature, but we're going to leave a lot of piles of it around. In fact, we now make projectiles out of it because it's such dense material, can be used for piercing armor. And so if you think about our archaeologists finding these arrowheads, spear points, the Clovis people, for example, future archaeologists will find these pretty radioactive things that are going to probably stick around for a few billion years.
Let's hope they know they're radioactive.
Well, unfortunately, they may not know. And, you know, there are some interesting passages in this book where we're talking about buried things, be it buried carbon dioxide, if we learn how to sequester carbon dioxide, or buried radioactive waste. There's a couple of such burial sites in the world right now, and how we can inform the future. Don't dig here. Languages mutate so fast that within 600 years, language is almost unintelligible to the previous speakers of it. I mean, just think of medieval English, for example.
Right.
And, there's now like an EPA regulation that the buried radioactive waste in New Mexico, we have to have signage that warns people or anything for the next 10,000 years to not dig there, so that they're still trying to figure out how to do that. These are interesting problems that give an interesting perspective on what our impact is and our lasting impact. On the nice side of things, our artwork, paintings aren't going to last very long, but ceramics are chemically similar to fossils, and unless they're crushed, they will last for an awful long time, way into the future. And bronze is another one of our most durable materials, even more durable than stainless steel. And it's nice to think of Rodin sculptures being there long after we are gone. Radio waves, they, like light waves, just keep leaving the Earth in an expanding sphere, and even though they get more and more and more diffuse, they're always still kind of out there, just headed towards eternity, and carrying with them our thoughts, our ideas. they're even more permanent than these gold records that we attach to the Voyager spacecraft that carry some of the most compelling images, sounds, and music, ranging from indigenous people to Louis Armstrong to the Queen of the Night's aria from Mozart's Magic Flute, which reaches the highest note in the operatic repertoire. That's right now on two spacecraft that are beyond the solar system, and they're going to be out there for at least a billion years. And if someone or something ever finds those things and follows the mathematical instructions of how to play that golden record, they will sort of hear this symbol of how far we could reach.
It might be us, and we'll figure that it's probably aliens that created it.
Well, there's also that possibility, too.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. So what's next for you? Do you have any new projects you're working on?
Or? Well, I am right now trying to decide between a couple of themes as to what should be my next book. I mean, you know, this last one, it went 5 billion years into the past. I mean, I had to determine what the world was like before us so I could give a baseline to show, you know, what it might return to. And then I just projected billions of years into the future, and it's kind of a tough act to follow. But, you know, what I came away from in this book is that life is so resilient. Life will go on. The planet's going to be in fine shape. It always bounces back from devastation and does so in magnificent ways. But whether we can hold on and whether the parts of the ecosystem that we love can survive, that really depends on us deciding and making some hard but very imaginative and creative and perhaps exciting decisions on how we're going to move into the future. So I think that's probably what I'm going to keep writing about.
Well, that's a good message, and I'm not sure I see the political will out there right now to really make some significant changes, but it does seem that market forces are causing some changes, you know, just in the fields of energy. And
well, and it's going to be a combination of all kinds of things. I mean, you know, political will moves when people sense a need for it, and you know, 15 years ago, Al Gore wrote a book called Earth in Balance. He understood very well then that the atmosphere was overheating, and yet he was ridiculed. And now he's getting a Nobel Peace Prize for saying the same thing. So that means that the public is coming around to understand it. Of course, at the same time, the Nobel Committee gave a Nobel Prize in Economics to three economists who preach growth-based economics, which, of course, you know, continued economic growth is what's heating up the atmosphere.
Right.
So, like most of us, we'd sort of like to have it both ways. We'd like to have our planet needed, too, and obviously we can't. We're going to have to learn a way to control the way we use the planet and probably to control the numbers of us who are using the planet. And like I say, you know, these are exciting opportunities that are going to require will and imagination, but if we don't do it, nature is going to do it for us. And I would just assume that we take our intelligence and turn it into wisdom, and take, you know, and really take responsibility for our own future.
Well, Alan, thank you very much for being on the show today. It was a great talking to you, and I wish you the best of luck.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Cosmic Influence. Thanks again for joining us. Our guest today was Alan Weisman, author of The World Without Us. If you'd like more information on his book, you can visit www.worldwithoutus.com. Walter and I would also like to remind you about the CPAC conference that we have coming up this October 4th and 5th of 2008 on the campus of UCSD in the Mandeville Center. If you'd like more information on the lineup and the details of the conference, please feel free to visit the website there at www.cpaconline.com. And don't forget, Walter's book, Lost Star of Myth and Time, is available at bookstores and on Amazon.com. So have a great week, and until our next episode, bring on the higher ages.